KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. And this is Writers' Voices. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. And because of the snowstorm we had last night, I'm going solo today. My lovely mother didn't make it over from Mount Pleasant, so we're Writers' Voices with just Monica today instead of Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. And, boy, for some reason, I don't seem to be speaking very loudly. I'm watching the lights over there. I'm going to have to speak up. So this is Writers' Voices, and with us today we have a very prolific and well-known author, Iowa author.
Yes.
Yes. Lee Michaels is the author of 80 contemporary romance novels and several single-title historicals set in 1800s London. More than 35 million copies of her books have been printed worldwide and translated into 25 languages. Six titles have been finalists in the Rita Concert, sponsored annually by Romance Writers of America. She has received Reviewer's Choice Awards from Romantic Times and has written nonfiction books on writing, including On Writing Romance and Creating Romantic Characters. She teaches writing at in-person seminars and on the internet at Gotham Writers Workshop. And she and her husband, Michael Lemberger, are co-authors of a number of nonfiction local history books as well.
That's right.
Including Ottumwa, A History of Her Hometown in Vintage Postcards. And the credits go on and on. So, Lee, welcome to Writers' Voices and welcome to Fairfield.
Thank you, Monica. It's a beautiful day.
I'm assuming this isn't your first time here.
Of course not.
So, the first thing that springs to mind is, how did you get started writing romance novels?
I have always been a writer from the time that I was very, very small. In fact, there is poetry in my baby book that I didn't write down. I couldn't write yet, so I dictated it to my long-suffering elder sister, and she wrote down my very terrible poems for me, and my mother put them in my baby book. My mom has been heard to say that I was a difficult birth because I had a book in my hand at the time, and I refused to put it down. So I've always been a writer, and I've always liked happy endings, or at least resolved endings, and I've always liked love stories. So it was a natural for me to read and then to write in the romance field.
Was it hard to get published as a romance writer when you started out?
Well, remember that I started in the dark ages. I've been at this for rather a long time. And when I started, it was before things like Romance Writers of America were prominent, and before there was a lot of, there weren't writing classes and things of that sort like there are now. So I taught myself to write. I read romance. I read it exhaustively. I figured out how it worked. I considered what I would have done instead of how the author pursued that story. And then I wrote my own books. I wrote my first romance novel when I was 14 years old. I knew enough about love, I should have stuck it on a Post-it note. And then I wrote five more complete books, and I burned the first six books that I wrote. But that was how I learned how to tell a story and how to create a character that I could carry through with a book-length project.
You really did burn them.
I really did burn them. Wow. I literally burned them in the barbecue pit.
At what age did you do that? You started writing when you're 14.
I started writing when I was 14. By the time I was 27, I had burned 6 books, at least 250,000 words up in smoke.
Wow.
And then the seventh book.
Any regrets for having done that?
Oh, absolutely not. No. For one thing, those early efforts are not around anymore to embarrass me. And secondly, everything that was good about those stories stayed in my head. And I've used those bits and pieces since. But because I had burned the pages that those words were on, I wasn't tempted to go back and try over and over to make them work. Sometimes the fresh start is just better. Sometimes when you've struggled with a project, it's just better to lay it aside and start with a fresh piece of paper. And that was what I did.
It's interesting. Sometimes authors are not able to publish or sell their first books, but then later, after they sell later books, they go back
to do earlier ones.
I think John Grisham is one who's
that happens to a lot of people when they initially make that breakthrough. Then an editor will say, "What else do you have on the shelf?"
Yeah.
And many times it's true that an earlier book might not be quite as attention grabbing, but it's still a very, very good story and it's well told. So it makes a good second or third book, but it isn't strong enough to be the breakout book. That wasn't the case with my 6. They were just dreadful and would have embarrassed me.
Okay, so what made the 7th different?
The 7th book was different because from the very beginning, I felt different about it. The characters rose up off the page. The story flowed better. And I knew when I finished that book that I had learned as much as I could on my own. I needed somebody else to tell me what was wrong with it. And so at that time, I said, the only way for me to find out more is to submit this. And I was not hoping to get an acceptance. I wasn't that unrealistic. But I really hoped to get the rejection letter that said, no, but here's why. So that I could use that then in the next project. So I gathered up my materials. I checked out Writer's Market, and they told me to send synopsis and sample chapters to Harlequin. And I decided to go with Harlequin. There were other publishers at the time. But I wanted to start with the biggest one and work my way down if I needed to.
That makes sense.
So I got my materials together, and they didn't explain what synopsis and sample chapters meant, so I did it all wrong. And I mailed this package off on Friday the 13th. I really couldn't have done anything worse, actually. And it came back to me 4 months later from the British arm of the company, which is called Mills & Boon. And with a letter that said, we think if you can revise this along the following lines, that we might be able to publish your book. And so I just started to scream and screamed for quite a while. And then I did that revision and another set of revisions. And then that was the first book that I sold.
And it was published in the UK? Or
it was published. It actually was first published in Australia. Published in the United Kingdom. And that one has been in at least 25 languages around the world.
Wow. Now, is that your favorite book that you've
written? No, it is a favorite, but I've learned and developed a lot more since then. My stories are tighter now. The characters are better. I did ask my editor one time, since that was such a bad submission, I did say, you know, what was it that pulled that off the shelf? What would have attracted you to that? Because I had sent her all the wrong stuff. And she said, it's because from the very first page, the heroine rose up as a real character. She was not a Barbie doll. She was in the middle of action, and I wanted to know more about her.
Oh. Well, that's great. What's the title of that book?
That one is The Grand Hotel.
The Grand Hotel.
It was the first one that I sold.
And that was the first of very, very many.
Very, very many. I wrote 80 sweet traditional contemporary romances for Harlequin Romances and Harlequin Presents. And then I burned out.
Oh.
80 books in 20 years will do that to you. And I started, instead of thinking about boy meets girl, boy wants girl, boy can't have girl, I started finding myself thinking about boy kills girl. And I thought it was time to take a break from writing fiction at that point.
Maybe fit right into the vampire romance craze.
Sure.
Did you think of switching to that?
Yeah. So I took some time off, and then when I went back to writing fiction, I started writing short stories for a change, and the short stories started getting longer. And I was exploring different venues and different kinds of stories. And I began writing one set in 1815 London, which I thought was a short story. And as I kept going, I was on the phone with my critique partner one day and said, this is a short story, but it just won't end. And she said, no, I think it's a book. I think there's a book trying to get out of your head. I said, no, it's a story. And she said, well, then there are more stories. Mm. And that was how this idea went from being what I really did think was a short story to a novella, and then the three interconnected novellas that make up The Mistress's House, which is the first of my historicals.
Once you started down that road, that seemed to be the new road for you, the historical romance?
I am really enjoying the historical romance. Yeah. It changed a lot of things in my career. I went from short books to long books, from contemporary to historical, from category romance to single title romance, where the books stand alone and are marketed independently, and from sweet stories to very, very spicy stories. So I changed publishers as well. So I really changed just about everything I could because of that burnout, just to be able to enjoy writing again.
Well, you're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Lee Michaels, and she has recently published The Mistress's House, which is her 80-something book. 81st book that she's published, but the first in many ways.
Yes.
It's new in many, many ways. Well, let's talk about some of those changes and how they impact you, how they impact how you write, how you work. So, obviously, going from contemporary to historical is a big difference.
Means a lot of research.
A lot of research. And how do you go about conducting that research? Have you been to London?
I have. The last time that we were in London, we were fortunate enough to be house-sitting for an editor. Mm-hmm. And it was a tough job, but somebody had to do it. And we were there for 7 weeks. So we lived about a mile north of Buckingham Palace. And every morning we'd get up and have breakfast and say, what do you want to do today? Where do you want to go? And so we did a lot of wonderful things. We went to the flower show at Hampton Court Palace. We went to Windsor. We went all around the London area. And we would hop on a bus or the tube, the subway, and then at random just get off and walk. Though I did say after a while I would never go out without a map again. But we would just wander around London. We walked a couple of hundred miles in that time.
Wow.
And including walking down Seymour Street, what's now called Seymour Street, which is where the mistress's house actually was. The address of the mistress's house is number 5 Upper Seymour Street, and there was a house there during the Regency period. It shows up on maps of the time. There are, of course, no photos or drawings of it. But the location is accurate, and I know what the garden looked like from this map. I know what the footprint of the house was. And so it was easy to imagine that house being the setting of these stories.
And how did you choose that particular spot in all of London?
Because I absolutely love the address. Number 5, Upper Seymour Street.
That's fantastic.
And it's located around the corner from Portman Square, which is where one of my heroes has his real house. And so it was an appropriate place for him to buy this little townhouse and use it as a location to hide away his mistresses.
Yeah.
And that's
And do you think that type of thing happened during that time period?
It definitely did. Yes. There have always been affairs. There have always been many times the marriages of the time were made for political reasons and for financial reasons. And so often after there was an heir born, a couple would decide actually they really didn't want to have that much to do with each other anymore. And there were a lot of affairs. There were a lot of couples that just simply had very civil marriages. Divorce was unheard of, or very nearly unheard of. It took an act of parliament to get a divorce. So that would be like getting a bill through Congress every time somebody wanted to get out of a marriage.
Ooh.
So very, very difficult to leave a marriage. And therefore, there were certainly a lot of affairs going on.
Probably it was more likely for marriage to end because of one party dying.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the lifespan was not as long. Even though they may have married younger, the average marriage probably wasn't nearly as long as it can be now.
I know. That's kind of interesting, isn't it, when you think about historically a 50 or 60 year marriage would have been
almost
rarity.
Unheard of. It
yes.
would have been very rare.
Yeah.
Even though women of the time were frequently married at 17 or 18, a girl would go to London for her season, her coming out season. And that was the opportunity to be a part of the marriage market and to and that was actually what they called it.
Oh, they did.
They did. It was the marriage market. You went to London at the spring of your 17th or 18th year. And the season was from right after Easter until early summer. And that was the opportunity for young men and women to get to know each other, to dance, to flirt, to walk in the park, to ride in carriages, and to make the marriages, make the arrangements for marriages.
Wow. Were the men usually older?
The men were often a little older, yes. And that was another reason why there were so many mistresses. It was the accepted thing for a young man to, as they said, sow his wild oats and have a series of flings with perhaps inappropriate people.
That he couldn't possibly marry
because they were not of the aristocracy. And then when he was ready to settle down, he would look around for the young, very virginal. It sounds a little bit like Charles and Diana.
I was just thinking that, and we all know how that worked out.
We know how that worked out.
So it probably wasn't that different from how things worked out in that.
No, except that it wouldn't have been as public.
It wouldn't have been as public, and they wouldn't have been able to get divorced at any point.
Exactly.
Yeah. Wow. So in the mistress's house, like you mentioned, you started out with a novella.
Yes.
And
ended up with three novellas together.
And is that the same structure that you're using for your
other books? Because this one sort of came about accidentally, and I really thought it was one story, and then it turned into the three stories because the house actually became a character in this book. And so when the first story is finished and the house is going to be empty, then the heroine loans it to her friend, who is the star of the second story. She too finds love while she's staying there, and then it's used as a retreat for the Earl's ward, and that's the third story. Because of the way that this book came about, the stories are very much interlinked, but they're separate. They're sequential stories. In the other books, one that's coming out in July called Just One Season in London, and the one coming out in November, which is called The Wedding Affair, the stories are very much interwoven. So you go back and forth from one to the other, and the stories are all ongoing at the same time because they involve a group of people.
Okay. So it's more of a traditional novel format.
More of a traditional novel format in the other two books.
Okay. You have three books coming out this year.
Yes.
Are they all completely written?
They are.
They're all finished?
They are all finished.
When did you start writing them, and how long does it take you to?
It took me about 18 months to write the three books. Or a little bit more. The Mistress's House, I actually started writing right about 2 years ago now. And it took a little while. It often does with the first book because there isn't a slot held for it in the publishing world. And so when a publisher finds a first book by a new author or somebody like me coming back into the field in a whole different way, they don't have a slot reserved for that book. And so it pushes out a little bit further before that one can hit the market. Mm-hmm. Then after they buy the first one, they know the others are coming. And so they go ahead and hold slots for those books, even though nobody may know yet what those books are going to be.
Now, is there a desire on the publisher's part to have those books come out as quickly thereafter as possible?
It depends on the publisher. Some of them want to do one book a year per author. Some of them would really like to have two. My particular editor said, I need three books within the first 12 to 18 months that I can publish in that length of time in order to really establish you well. Mm-hmm. So I would have preferred to write one book a year. I ended up writing two in a year to fill that contract.
Now, how does the market for historical romance differ from the sweet contemporary romance market that you have had so much experience with?
There's actually more difference between single title and category books than there is between contemporary and historical. Historicals now tend to all be single title books, so that sort of adds in there. But the books that I was writing for Harlequin all fell under the category, which means that they're actually published more like magazines than they are like traditional novels. Every month there are four or six or eight titles in this particular line. And after those books have had their appearance on the bookstore shelves for 2 to 4 weeks, then they're pulled off and the next set of books go onto the shelf. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of like category romance. It's sort of like walking into the store, you know, the Hy-Vee, and saying, I'd like last month's Time magazine. you know, it's not going to happen.
Right.
You can find
it
at the library.
Right.
And category romance now with the internet, fortunately, they stay available much longer because you can order them. The stores that don't have the brick and mortar shelving, you know, can keep them in stock much longer. But that's the downside of category romance.
Oh, interesting.
And single title ones then are available all the time until they actually go out of print. There's not a time limit on them.
And the category romance are shorter.
These ones are shorter, yes.
Not necessarily
all of them. But the category that I was writing for was about 50,000 words, 55,000 words. And the single title books are about 90 to 95,000 words.
Okay. Do you like having that longer, you know, be able to develop a story more completely and have more sort of side stories?
I really like the ability to have the triple stories because there's always so much going on and the interactions between the characters. It isn't just between this hero and this heroine, but it might be this hero and somebody else's heroine. And so the cast keeps changing and moving, and sometimes you don't even know who's going to end up with who in the books, which makes it fun for the author.
Oh, so when you start, you don't necessarily know the ending.
I don't necessarily know the ending.
It'll be a happy ending.
I know it will be a happy ending. I know it'll be a resolved ending, and I know everybody will end up with somebody that's perfect for them. But I don't always know the happy ending for each individual character.
Now, do you ever think that this paints an unrealistic picture of romance?
Of romance?
Although you seem to have your happy ending sitting here in the studio with us.
Yes, my husband is here with me today, and he's with me all the time. He's very, very supportive, and in fact, that's one of the reasons my pen name includes his first name. That's a question that's often asked, and people who don't read a lot of romance often think, well, you know, these are such glamorized situations that they make readers think, well, okay, I just wait for my Prince Charming to come along and sweep me off my feet. But actually, the message that romance sends is, I am a worthwhile woman on and of my own. Having a man is not a necessary thing. It's a wonderful thing. It completes my life. It makes me better. But I do not have to have a man. I do not have to sacrifice to have a man. I'm willing to wait for a man who completes me. And I actually have received letters from teenage girls who said, you know, thank you for writing that book, because I know now that it's okay for me to wait until I find a guy who will treat me right.
Oh, wow.
And that feels wonderful.
I bet it does. And is that, have these, that category of romance, do you feel that has always been the message, or has that changed over the years?
It has always been the message. Even early on, in the early 1900s, when category romance first came to be, it was on the cutting edge of exploring social issues. Even, you know, long before divorce was socially acceptable, romance was looking at the times that maybe it might be better for this couple if they didn't continue their marriage. There were even a few of those kinds of stories. So it's always been on the cutting edge. It's always been a fairly feminist heroine, and has always made the point that economic independence for women is very important, so she isn't trapped in a marriage.
Are most romance writers women?
The majority of romance writers are women. There are a significant number of men who write romance. Most of them do it under a feminine or a gender-neutral name. The president of Romance Writers of America a few years back was a guy whose name was Harold, but he wrote as Lee Greenwood.
Wow.
So, yeah, for a group that you would think would be entirely women, nope, we elected a man. And an amazing number of romance readers are men. I think the latest figure is 22% of romance readers are men. A lot of them don't talk about it.
I expect not.
Yeah, there are a couple of judges that I know, Supreme Court and Appeals Court jurists, who would have a row of cases that they were working on, and then there'd be a row of my books, and they'd use them as relaxation. And some men join the book club by mail, but they put their wife's name on the account so the mailman won't know, you know, things like that.
They don't come in brown paper packages.
No, well, they come in brown boxes, but
but it says romance. Something
it says on romance
the
on it.
So, Lee, when you started writing your historical novels, you say you switched publishers. Was that a necessity for you? Was it because Harlequin didn't do this type of book?
Harlequin does do this type of book. I felt like I needed a change at that point. And I had a new agent, and this was the deal that we decided was the best for me at this point in my career.
At what point in your career did you get an agent?
For the category romances, I never did have an agent. For my nonfiction, I did along the way. Okay. So I've worked with three or four different agents in the course of my career. The agents mainly feel that with category romance, the contracts are pretty much boilerplate. It's very difficult to make significant changes in those contracts. And when you get into single title, then there's a lot more negotiating to be done. Okay. So then's when you really, really need an agent.
Okay.
And I have a wonderful agent.
That's great. That's great.
You had asked about fan mail. I do get a lot of fan mail and a lot from around the world. Not so much now in actual mail. Now it's all email. But one of the most effective promotions that I've done through the years, and I started it almost accidentally, I got a fan letter, I answered it. And I've always done that. And I think that has really paid off because of the personal relationship and the bond. I have fans who have been with me and on my mailing list for 15 years. And one of them showed up at an event that I had a couple months ago. She just popped up. You know, she didn't live too far away, and I'd sent her a postcard, and she came. She was just thrilled.
Oh.
So, you know, over that long course of time, it's wonderful to have built those relationships. But some of those letters are really touching. There was one from a reader in California a few years back who said the book was a category romance, and it was a case where my hero and my heroine were trapped in a cabin out in the woods in an ice storm, and they were exposed to carbon monoxide poisoning.
Wow.
And she wrote to me, and she said, "I am so glad you wrote that book." She said, "I was reading it while I was home with the flu. I thought I had the flu, and the longer I read the book, the more I thought, this sounds like me. So I had my furnace checked, and I was being carbon monoxide poisoned." And she said, "You may have saved my life."
Oh, my goodness.
So whenever anybody asks me if research is important, yes, it is.
It obviously
I had spent days in the health sciences library at Indian Hills Community College looking up cases of carbon monoxide poisoning, how the people were exposed, what the symptoms were, how it was discovered, how they were treated. And so that was all woven into that story.
Did you happen to run across a case I read about recently that was, I think, maybe at the turn of the 1900s, where a family thought their house was haunted because they were having these, you know, seeing things and so forth.
And it was carbon monoxide? Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
That would be a very effective plot.
Wouldn't it, though?
And that's a good example of how anything that you run across can be the genesis of a book idea.
Absolutely.
Because that would be a wonderful one.
Now, when you're doing the research for your historical novels, how accurate do you feel you need to be in terms of what could have actually happened during that time period, how people could have would have actually spoken to each other?
You need to be, that's a really good question, because you need to be a balance between what really happened and what the modern reader will accept. The historical heroine tends to be a little more feminist than she probably was during that period of time, a little more outspoken, a little more forward-thinking. And the same with heroes. You know, a man at that era might have really been very strict with a wife or a partner, where in today's romance, you know, there's an element of political correctness here.
Right, right.
As far as talking, it's important to sprinkle in enough to remind the reader of where she is and when she is without being completely incomprehensible. The Regency hero, you know, if he said, I'll put a pony on that question, he doesn't mean literally a small horse. He means an amount of money. And I think it was a monkey was 500 pounds. I think a pony was 25 pounds.
Oh.
So, you know, all those things, you know, and those resources are out there, but you have to go hunting for them.
I bet. Was that, do you enjoy that
hunting? I do enjoy hunting it down. And I feel like I've been doing research for these books my whole life, because this is a period of English history that I've always enjoyed, always liked reading about. So I feel I've been absorbing this through you know, many, many years of reading.
What other kind of books do you like to read?
I like to read mysteries to relax with, especially cozies. And, you know, that whole boy kills girl thing. You know, at some point I may actually write a cozy mystery series. If I get tired of historicals, I'll make another change in reincarnation. I read a lot of nonfiction in many, many areas because it feeds. When you keep writing, you're pouring out stuff all the time. You have to replace that and pour it in, or you don't have anything new to write about.
Good point. Good point. And you never, like you say, you never know where you're going to find the next story.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, when I am asked about new writers, what should I study, especially kids? You know, I want to be a writer. What do I study? And I say everything, because you don't know what you're going to need. Do a broad range in your college career. Take a little bit of everything, because then you know what's out there and you know where to start looking for it. And you know where you're most interested. But if you haven't had art appreciation, you don't know where to begin going to look for information about that.
Right. That's a good point. So that's where a liberal arts degree really...
And the more liberal, the better. The broader, the better.
Great. And is that your background?
That is my background. I have a Bachelor of Arts in Journalism from Drake University.
Ah.
I did my 4 years of college in three, so I didn't come out of there with too much student debt. And... enjoyed my college career. If I had it to do over again and knew then what I know now, I probably would have stayed that extra year and done a whole lot more expansion classes of, you know, a little bit of this and a little bit of that.
It's never too late.
That's true. I may go back yet. I started a master's at one time and never followed through with it. One of my editors did tell me that she felt my journalism background was extremely valuable for me in a couple of ways. One is that journalism teaches you to be very careful with words and to use the right one instead of the almost right one, and to write very tersely and clearly. And she said that made my books much easier to translate, and that's why I was picked up in so many languages so quickly.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Now, did you ever work as a journalist?
I did. I briefly worked at the Ottumwa Courier. And then I was news director for a radio station in Ottumwa for a period of time. I worked in public relations for a while. And then I went to work at the library and had a great time there, because when I was reshelving books, I'd, you know, sneak a peek at all of them. I basically read everything that came back into the library. And had, you know, wonderful research experience there as a reference librarian. And then I left that job to write full time.
Now, the internet has changed everything, hasn't it?
It certainly has.
Does it make your job easier?
In many ways, access to the internet makes things easier. You can Google and find a lot of information. It's also made it harder, because it's even more difficult to know if it's accurate information or if it's just something that somebody's put up there. So, you know, and also it's very tempting to do that instead of, you know, sticking to work. You know.
That is true.
Yes, I can surf the internet for a long time without realizing how
research.
Long it's been. It's all research, absolutely. So it has made it easier in many ways, but also more challenging in others.
Wow. Well, you're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Lee Michaels, the author of The Mistress's House. Lee, would you like to read a section from this book for us? Nope, we're going to pass on the reading. Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about, you mentioned that you teach writing.
I do.
So let's talk a little bit about that.
I teach romance writing for Gotham Writers Workshop in New York City. I teach online. It's writingclasses.com. Gotham is a bricks and mortar school of writing, has been for years in Manhattan, but their online division is very, very widespread and allows us to do a lot of genre classes and things that I have students right now. I have one in Australia. I've had students in Russia, Israel, South America. I've got a couple in Brazil right now, too.
Wow.
So everybody can sign on at their convenience, pick up their assignments, comment on the lecture and the discussion, come to a chat once a week if they're able to. It's like going out for coffee after class. Submit their work and get feedback on it from me and from the other students. And in the years that I've been teaching at Gotham and also the in-person seminars that I do, I now have about 30 to 35 students who have gone on to publish commercially.
Fantastic.
It is fantastic.
Wow, that's
because
kind of like
when they call me up,
isn't it?
Exactly. That's exactly what it is, because when they call me up and say, you know, they called, I'm going to sell my book. I feel exactly like a grandma, because I didn't do any of the hard work, but I get to exclaim over the wonderful baby.
Oh, yes. So you're saying, is it kind of like an actual class with that starts at this time and ends
it's
6 months later?
It's a 10-week class, and the online classes are available 24 hours a day. So the first thing that I do in the morning is check my email, and then I look in on my classes and see what's been posted since the day before and if I need to make any comments. Each week, the student puts in an assignment that is in a private area between the student and me. And, you know, it may be a scene, it may be, here's what my conflict is all about, and I comment about that back to the student, and that's private between the two of us. A couple of times during the term, then they post a section of their work, and all the students in the classroom comment on it. The classes are limited to 16, and, it's a great opportunity for people to share their work, to get feedback from first readers who are also experienced in the field, which is a little different than going to a random writer's group where you may have somebody writing mystery, somebody writing sci-fi, somebody writing a literary novel.
Right.
And the feedback can be all over the place because they may not know the market.
That's true.
So this is a focused group that knows the market as well as the
stories. Now, how do you post lectures?
It's in a classroom situation where I post a lecture, and then when they sign in with their password, they could read that week's lecture and the discussion board.
Okay, so it's in writing.
It is in writing.
Okay, it's not
in writing.
Podcast
mm-hmm.
or something.
Yeah,
like
we haven't gone on to podcast yet, but and the chats that we have, because we have students around the world, it's absolutely impossible to find an hour of the week that everybody's available. So those are not instruction times, but they are good opportunities to ask questions, get clarification, brainstorm ideas, and all of those things then are archived so students can come back and read them afterwards if they couldn't be there.
So when you post a lecture, like you've been doing this for a number of years, mm-hmm. so do you have this, like the lectures are pre-written?
The lectures are written, and so when a new class starts, I will post the lectures for that period of time. And each week we focus on an area like dialogue or point of view or conflict or characters or setting. And then we'll discuss from that and questions and back and forth. And then the assignment that week is something to do with that particular field.
Now, with as successful as you've been publishing and as many books as you write, why do you take the time to do this teaching?
Partly because when I started out, I would have given anything to have someone that I could have gone to and said, okay, Writer's Market says send three sample chapters and a synopsis, but what do they mean? Would you look at it and see if it's good? You know, because I would have given anything to have a mentor myself, I enjoy mentoring others. And also, because writing is a lonely profession, this is a great opportunity for somebody in Ottumwa, Iowa, where there are, is one romance writer.
And I'm looking at her.
Yeah, and you're looking at me, to have contact with other people who understand when I say, they woke me up at 2 a.m. yakking again. I'm not crazy. It's just my characters.
Now, you must occasionally have students who really don't write very well. How do you
that
handle
happens.
That?
I try never to discourage anybody, because some of the ones who honestly have come in looking the most unpromising have been the ones who had the persistence, stuck with it, and got published.
Seriously?
Seriously.
Wow.
Sometimes the very, very first thing they posted was just honestly horrible, but they stuck to it and they learned.
And you never said, this is horrible.
I never said, this is horrible. I would say, here are the things I liked. Gotham's philosophy is an excellent one for teaching writing. We start with two things we like, and then we make two suggestions for improvement. And while it's wonderful to hear, oh, this is great, we don't improve our writing by hearing that.
Right.
It helps because we know what we do well and what we can build on. And I will never forget a writing instructor who read one of my pieces early on and said, "This girl writes like Truman Capote." You know, yeah, that one stuck.
Wow.
But at the same time, we learn from the suggestions for improvement. And it is very much true that a writer cannot judge her own writing effectively, because when I look at what I've put on the page, I don't just see the words. I think again about what I was thinking when I wrote it. And so I need a reader's perspective to be able to know what's
exactly
what I really put on there. Did I get enough information on there? Because I know where that character was and what that character looks like, but did I tell the reader that?
Exactly. And did I tell the reader that, but also leave them some room to fill in
exactly
the details in their yes own mind so they can identify with the character?
Absolutely.
Even more.
Yeah. So you always tell the reader the things that are different about this situation or this room or this character or this event, and then you let her fill in the rest from what she already knows or what she wants to picture.
Right, right. So, Lee, let's talk a little bit about some of your nonfiction books that you brought with you. Mm-hmm. And you have, some of them are on writing.
Yes, the main one that I did on writing is called On Writing Romance, and it was brought out by Writer's Digest Books a couple of years ago. Mm. I had written, as I was teaching classes, I assembled materials that I wanted my students to have, and that turned into a textbook called Writing the Romance Novel that I self-published because I needed it then, and I needed it for my students. So after that one went through three editions, I happened to be at a writer's conference in Indiana, and there was an editor from Writer's Digest Books there, and I introduced myself and said, you know, you turned down my book a year or two ago, my How to Write Romance book. And she got kind of a funny color and a funny look on her face, and she said, "The book that we were going to bring out fell through. I would like to look at yours again." And so before we were done with that writer's conference, we basically had hammered out a deal to do On Writing Romance.
Wow.
Which was very effective. I went home and called my agent and said, "Hey, I've got a deal for you to finish."
Absolutely.
And then there's also one called Creating Romantic Characters, and this one was written as the textbook when I was teaching a Barnes & Noble class online. So
I didn't
it's,
even know they did classes.
Yeah, they did.
Online.
They no longer are doing it, but it was a wonderful resource for a period of time. And so that one was involved in there. And then I've done the local history books as well. And among the other things that we did while I was taking that break from writing fiction is we publish books. So we not only published our own local market niche market nonfiction books, but we published some for other people as well.
So, really?
Yes.
So these, tell us a little bit more about what you're looking for as a publisher.
As a publisher, I'm looking for focused books that have a very specific market, very specific audience, and authors who are motivated to promote those books and create that audience, get the word out to that audience. So among the ones that we've done, I brought with me A History of St. Joseph Hospital in Ottumwa. And that came about because there was going to be a reunion of the nursing students. St. Joe Hospital operated from 1914 to 1971 and taught student nurses and x-ray technicians most of that time. So because of that upcoming reunion event, it seemed a perfect time to do a history of the hospital, and they were very helpful in helping us get that information. So that's the kind of thing that we're looking for. Another one that we did is Mars Hill Church. It's on the Wapello-Davis County border between Ottumwa and Bloomfield. It's the oldest log cabin church that's still in continuous operation, still being used in the United States. And again, it's got a lot of fantastic history in it, and included in this book is a list of everybody who's buried in the cemetery up to the time that this book was brought out. So the local focus and the being able to reach an audience with the books is what's important.
And are you using, in terms of how you actually publish, are you using print on demand?
In these books, we are using print on demand. Yes. It used to be that when you self-published a book or went to a printer to get a book published, if you were a small publisher, 500 copies was about the minimum that you could effectively do, and it took 1,000 or 1,500 before you got a reasonable price.
Right.
Now with print on demand, we can do books that we think over the course of time will sell 200, 250 copies, and we don't have to print them all at once, which is the big benefit there.
Right.
Authors will make more from the books that they sell directly to their audiences. You know, we have people who go out and do programs, and they have a book of their columns or a book of their about their subject, and then sell that book directly. So we supply those books, and that's where the author really makes the most money. We are a commercial publisher. We are not able to pay advances, but we do not charge, and we pay royalties.
And how would somebody get in touch with you if they're interested?
They can check
this
on the internet at pbllimited.com.
PBL Limited.com. And Limited spelled out?
Limited is spelled out.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And does that stand for something that you want to share?
Well, it's a combination of things. My husband has a photography business, and when we added the publishing to it, we adopted the name.
Okay.
So it covered everything.
Great. So this is kind of, it's quite different from
writing. Everything else that I've done.
Yes.
Yeah. It keeps me fresh, keeps me busy, and keeps me out of trouble.
So the book that you wrote about romance characters, is that, did you also do that as print on demand?
That is available through a print on demand. We actually self-published this one because we had enough market share with it, with the Barnes & Noble classes.
Mm-hmm.
That happens to be one that was published locally.
Okay, in a traditional
In a traditional
print
model.
Method.
Mm-hmm. Traditional print method.
Great. Now, when you are doing this, there's a lot more than just the writing skills that come to play. There's the layout.
There's editing, there's layout, there's cover design, and the combination of my husband's skills as a photographer and artist and graphic designer and mine as a writer and editor. And we do the layout together and the production end of it together. So it's a marriage made in heaven, actually.
How romantic. What are some of the qualities that you have that have made you successful as a writer?
I am never satisfied to stop before with, I'm absolutely not satisfied with average. It has to be above average before I'm willing to quit with it.
Mm.
The third of the historicals that I wrote, I finished in October. It was due November 1st. And when I finished that book, I didn't have the wonderful sense of achievement and accomplishment and glee that I usually do when I finish a book. And so I knew it wasn't quite ready.
Wow.
It was perfectly adequate, but it wasn't good in the sense that I wanted it to be. And it took one more complete run through that book. And then I was very happy with it. And I think it may be the best of the three books that I've written. But I'm not satisfied with average. And I've never been content without reaching a little bit further with each book that I do. What can I do differently? What can I do better this time? How can I push that envelope a little bit more? And that, frankly, is what kept me writing after 80 books. You know, if I'd been doing the same story over and over again, I think I'd have been done a long time ago.
So did your writing change over that time period?
It has changed. It's much more focused. I'm deeper and more intricate plots, deeper characterization, much more emotion now than I had originally. And I think they're tighter stories. They fit together more intricately now than they used to.
Do you read your books after they're published?
I do.
You do?
I do. And I've now recently been in the business of rereading a lot of my early ones. About half of my early books, I have the rights back, too.
Ah.
And so I've been in the process of re-editing those books and putting them up as e-books. They're available on Nook and Kindle and all the e-readers. And I've been surprised and very pleased at how well the majority of them have held up. There are a couple that I'm still thinking, I'm not sure I'm going to bring this out again. But most of them have held up extremely well. Some of them have, in the course of time, become accidental historicals. There's one that's about a manufacturer of typewriter ribbons. And I thought about changing that as I re-edited it. And I thought, no, it was written in, you know, it was written in 1988, something like that. It's a historical novel now.
Now, what's actually involved in publishing them as e-books?
As e-books?
Yes.
It's an interesting process, and there are several ways to do it. You can go directly to Kindle. You can go directly to Nook. And I do that. But I've found that one of the ways that works the best for me is called Smashwords. It's a website called smashwords.com. And you upload a Word document. It's a bit of a process to get it edited in such a way that their software will not mangle it. But once you have your book in a Word document format that's acceptable to them, then they translate it into all the different formats for e-readers. So it can be downloaded as a Kindle, as a Nook, directly from their website. And they take a cut of whatever the reader pays for that book, and then the rest is funneled to the author.
So then it's only available on Smashwords? Is that what
Smashwords? Mine are available directly from Kindle. And they're available through Smashwords. They're available through Barnes & Noble.
Okay.
And, you know, various of the other sites.
Okay. So you can take the same book and publish it on Smashwords and publish it directly
yes.
with Kindle and
mm-hmm.
with Nook. And how do you then go about promoting?
I do a lot of promotion through my website, through blogs, through, again, just responding to everybody who contacts me through email, and word of mouth. I'm also involved in some groups of authors that are helping to promote each other's books.
What is your website?
LeeMichaels.com. LeeMichaels.com.
And do you blog on that as well?
I don't blog on that.
Okay.
I keep the website very much updated. I'm doing a blog tour right now for the Mistress's House, and the links are all on the website as to where I've been, and you know, so you can follow through and read all those bits.
What exactly is a blog tour?
A blog tour is where you make an appearance at various different readers' and writers' blogs, and that's scheduled a month or so in advance. And they'll send questions or a topic, and you write a blog about that or answer their interview questions. And then on the day that that's posted, you make an appearance and chat with their readers, respond to their questions.
So it's sort of an online book
tour. It's an online book tour.
Cool.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you set these up yourself, or do you
have... The publicist for the publisher does these.
Wow.
Though I have added some that I've had personal contact with other authors who blog, you know, other people, other clients of my agents who have blogs, and so I've added some of those as well.
You're listening to Writers' Voices. Our guest today has been Lee Michaels, author of The Mistress's House, and the upcoming novels, Just One Season in London, mm-hmm. published July 2011 by Sourcebooks Casablanca, and The Wedding Affair coming out in November.
Yes.
So, Lee, one of the things that impresses me so much about you is that you know, there's kind of this, people sometimes have this idea that writing is you just go write a book and send it out, and then you go write another book and send it out. But
there's a lot more to it than that.
There's so much more to it.
There is.
And probably more now than ever.
Absolutely more now than ever. It's become even more important for the writer to be a marketer and a publicist and a presence in order to draw readers to that book. There were 9,000 books published last year that were classified as romance novels.
Wow.
So to stand out among that, as one book among that presence, is difficult. And it's very important to reach readers and contact them and make a connection with them.
Do you find that your readers from the contemporary sweet romance are following you into this new genre?
A good many of them are, and I've tried to warn them because it is a very big jump.
Yeah,
from
let's talk about that for a minute.
It's a very big jump to go from the sweet traditional where, as one of my friends who writes erotica says, everything happens, all the sex happens above the neck, to a spicier book where there are actual explicit love scenes. My editor says that these books are sexy. My agent calls them sensual. I call them racy. they're intentionally titillating but they're also very emotional and warm. And there's nothing that happens in that book without the characters feeling very strongly for each other. It's not just sex, it's emotion.
Was it a leap for you to start writing these sex scenes?
It was. And I think because one of my writing partners is an erotica author, she was pushing me that direction, said, oh, yeah, sure, you can write it. You can write an explicit scene, Lee. I want to see one. And that was one of the reasons that I started writing.
Were you a little uncomfortable at first?
I have to make a couple of runs at every love scene before I'm happy with it, yeah.
Yeah. And, I don't know if you're... Like, if you have family members.
My mother's reading
this. Your mother's reading this?
She's 90.
And she's okay with it.
She seems to be perfectly fine with it. And I have an older friend. She's in her 70s. And I said, you know, this is going to be a pretty racy book. And she said, sign me up. And she looked at the cover of this one and said, that man can eat crackers in my bed any day.
So the cover, do you have anything to do with that?
Most authors don't have a whole lot to say about covers because that's a marketing decision that the publisher makes. I've been fortunate that my contract does give me cover approval, which means that I do get some say in what is on the cover. This one I just absolutely love. It's a very intimate, loving, emotional cover, and I'm very happy with it.
That is quite a gorgeous couple there.
It is, and there's something about a man in boots, a shirtless man in boots.
We don't see those every day, do we? That's great. Well, what advice would you give to aspiring writers?
Write a lot. Write and write and write some more. If you wait for inspiration, that's a cop-out. It isn't going to happen. But put yourself in the chair and write. You know, we wouldn't expect to pick up a tennis racket the first time and go out and play a championship game.
That's
true. We rehearse, we practice and practice and practice some more. So it's fine to read books about writing, it's fine to talk about writing, it's fine to think about writing, but the only way to learn to write is to write and then do it again and do it again.
And you mentioned you have a critique partner or a couple of them.
Mm-hmm.
And even after all these years and all your experience,
I still run things past a critique partner just to get, as I said before, you know, is what's on the page really what I think's on the page? Because
right.
I'm not sure of what I've actually put on there.
Sometimes I run into beginning writers who just don't want anything changed. They don't want a single word changed, and they're not going to get anywhere that way.
If you want to write for yourself, write a journal. If you want to write for an audience, then you have to accept that it may not be perfect on the page. Or even no matter how beautiful that prose is, it may just not fit in this book.
Throw the babies.
Throw
the darlings out.
Throw the darlings out. Kill your darlings.
Out. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. So you've done that.
I have definitely done that.
Do you save them for maybe what they might fit?
Oh, I save them because it's just too heartbreaking to delete them. But it's very, very rare that I go back and use anything from that. One of the historicals I started over three times, and the scenes that I had written originally were in a file till the end, but they never could be used. There just was nothing in there that I could actually use.
Well, we are out of time, and this has been an incredibly fun conversation for
Thank
me.
You.
Thank you so much for coming over, and we'll have you back on with one of your...
Sounds wonderful.
Let's plan on it after the November book comes out.
So that would be wonderful, Monica.
To talk about. Great. And this has been Lee Michaels and Writer's Voices. Stay tuned now for Planet Erstwhile, where host James Moore is taking us on another full-tilt tropical safari. Learn about local events, state and national politics, as well as the international arena with in-depth coverage of the historic revolutions unfolding in Libya and Algeria. Enjoy interviews with Francis Tickey, State Representative Kurt Hansen, Asma Youssef, Pastor Bibi Rail, etc., etc. And music will feature the Apocalypso Tantric Boys Choir, who are performing Friday night, tonight, February 25th, at Cafe Paradiso at 8 p.m. This is quite an amazing journey we have here. Thank you once again for joining with us, and see you next week on Writer's Voices. Thank you.
Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and WritersVoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.